to fruition here. It's simply I had a meeting with a very small producer in Manhattan, and they expressed interest in doing that. So if we can put that together,
that's terrific. Yeah, it's wonderful. Congratulations. I hope it works out. That's fantastic.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, JP. Thank you. So, okay, so JP, let's go ahead and update us on what you've got. You've got a couple of different topics that we'd like to address today. And the first one, of course, well, why don't you go ahead and explain the current work that you've been on last week and this week and whatnot.
Sure. I mean, I have topics that I'm more specialized than others. And I've been interested in what's going on in Spain is with the Catalan protest and movement there, and the fact that 9 political activists and actually Catalan separatists and Catalan regional government people were on trial and then sentenced to jail sentences. I was interested in that. I'm also interested in what's going on in Brazil and Amazonia because, I was a Fulbright scholar down there.
Yeah.
I also did research in Spain, too. So what's going on in Brazil now, you heard about the fires in Amazonia. Well, there's current fires in what's called the Pantanal, which is the marshy area, and that's going on. And Friday, on November 1st, there was an indigenous person from the Guajajara tribe or povo, he was murdered by illegal loggers in Maranhão, in the state of Maranhão in Brazil. Mm. And he was one of the, what are called, the guardians of the flores or guardas da floresta.
Okay.
So those are the kind of topics that we could talk about today if you'd like, or anything else, really. So,
okay, let me just mention this. The fires... The fires continue to burn almost wildly, and then there's varying reports on that. But in Brazil, the Amazon is being burnt. And I'm just thinking, as you're mentioning this, JP, I'm just thinking, it's like, for the past decade, it seems like California, the entire state of California, has been on fire. All these ridiculous fires in California. I wonder if there is any, if you sink in, global warming or any type of climate change. And of course, we've had on guests that have talked about, and these are literal to combat that. NASA's releasing various chemicals and whatnot, or whether into the atmosphere. So is that possibly drying out trees? I mean, that would be that's always that's been one of the arguments presented.
Well, I mean, as far as the climate change, as far as what I read, I'm not an expert on this at all, Ian. But I mean, as far as what I've read. Apparently and I think the science is pretty much overwhelming as far as climate change, global warming, and so on. I mean, the science is fairly overwhelming in that regard. I have a friend who works for NASA as well. He's an astrophysicist, though. But, I mean, from what I've read, that the conditions will be drier in the future, and the fires will get worse and more intensive in places like California.
Wow. Okay. So it's not, it's not looking good.
Not looking great. Yeah. And then the other thing is that, you not only have protests in Brazil, of course, but you have protests happening all over the world, Ian. I mean, so that touches upon like protests in Lebanon and protests in Chile. There were other indigenous leaders killed in Colombia. So it's not only Brazil. But the genocide in Brazil has been ongoing, if I could just segue into that, has been ongoing for quite some time. And the Catholic, it's called Indigenous Missionary Group, or CIMI, Conselho Indigenista Missionario, in Brazil, has reported that in 2018, the killing, murders of indigenous people has gone up 20%. And in the last 30 years, there's been over 1,000 Indians killed in general, 1,185, I think the statistic was, which, points to pretty clear evidence of a genocide, I would say.
Wow. And what's behind that? What's the motive behind that?
So a lot of the impetus behind this and a lot of the impetus behind the fires in the Amazon are from cattle ranchers in. And so they're called rancheros, and then other farmers, fazendeiros. So because of the president of Brazil, his name is Jair Bolsonaro, because of his policies of wanting to develop the Amazon, he's really opened up allowing the rancheros to, you know, set fire to their land, which in this time of year anyway, like, you have slash and burn agriculture of indigenous people anyway, but it's small time. And see, what happens with the Amazon is that it continuously rains because, you know, water is put in the atmosphere from the humid conditions, and you have this continual cloud coverage and rain. And see, if the Amazon burns, obviously it's been called the lungs of the world and so on. But the worry is that these fires have been out of control. And then if you listen to anthropologists and other environmentalists who are concerned, I mean, there's been several petitions written in regard to, you know, condemning Bolsonaro's actions or non-actions of what's happening in the Amazon. And now it's in the Pantanal, which is in the swampy areas burning. And so basically the ranchers, going back to the original question, the ranchers don't want Indians on their land, so they hire people to kill them, or they kill them themselves. And most of the killings are, let's see, majority of them have happened in states like Roraima and Mato Grosso do Sul, although this recent killing happened in Maranhão, which is northeast Brazil, which is the northeast kind of Amazonia.
My gosh, it sounds like a mess. Are there issues with the local power companies? And I mean, it may not be necessary, but I can't help but to try to somehow draw a parallel, if possible, to California with PG&E. And
that's interesting you brought that up, because of course another issue about indigenous land is that hydroelectric dams are being built in the Amazon and dam up the rivers and actually flood indigenous land, which displaces not only people but destroys wildlife there, which is the most diverse in the world. So you have that, the drive, let's say, to develop the Amazon has also driven the government to, you know, construct these hydroelectric dams, including the famous one in the Caiapó land, which is Belo Monte. And so that's happening too. And that's tied into power companies as well. And what some scientists have said is that, you know, in reality, they don't really need to build hydroelectric dams for power sources, although they could find alternative methods like wind or solar or something more environmentally friendly.
Yeah. Okay. And how long have you been following this, JP? You've been working on this for how long?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I had a Fulbright to Brazil 2018, 2009. This past year is when the fires have gotten really quite bad. I mean, I've been mostly looking at, to be honest, mostly looking at the indigenous political movements, mostly urban Amerindian groups. But, you know, because this is all part of the peace, right? It's all part of being, so what's happening is that illegal loggers are allowed to encroach on indigenous lands. People are allowed. So Bolsonaro said he doesn't want Indians having reservations or more demarcating any more indigenous land, allowing for mining companies to go in. There's a huge tragedy happening in northern Brazil where the Yanomami people live, in the garimpeiros there, which are gold miners who are putting mercury into the river waters, which is also happening in other parts of Brazil, but really another genocidal tragedy happening in the Yanomami land.
And what's the effect there with the mercury? It's poisoning them.
People are getting sick. People are getting poisoned by the mercury. The animals are dying. Fish kills. The river obviously is polluted, so it's affecting the environment, affecting the wildlife, affecting the people that live there. It's a huge problem.
Right. Okay. That's all right. So let's get into that kind of waste or that kind of taste our appetite here for what's happening in Brazil. Let's hit on nations, nationalism, and non-nation political movements is found on catapunch.org. It's released by you, JP, on October 25th. And there's an interesting, so for listeners and myself to understand what's happening here in Spain and the Catalonian segments. The article or the paragraph here is interesting. You're paralleling it to what's recently happened in the United States, and your quote,
right.
Your paragraph reads. In fact, many Americans are often unaware of their nationalist sentiments. Take, for example, the kneeling controversy of the American football player Colin Kaepernick, who we haven't heard about much. I think there was an issue with him and Nike and some sort of a flag,
right.
American flag on the
right.
Nike shoe that he wanted them to take right. down. But but widely known in 2016 during an NFL game, and it became a habit for him, he began kneeling to protest the national anthem.
Right.
And you go on to say the act of kneeling during the national anthem provoked many strong emotions in many Americans. What's happening here in the Catalonia?
All right. So I brought the Colin Kaepernick case in the NFL just to kind of show that how provocative and how emotional nationalism can be, or patriotism, right?
Okay.
That even in Americans, who a lot of people love the NFL and watch it, and that's a huge controversy, right? I mean, that happened kind of during the election year last cycle, 2016, and the president, or current president, weighed in. I don't think he was president at the time, but he weighed in on the issue, right?
Yeah.
Condemning Kaepernick and the whole thing, and then Kaepernick said he was doing it for as part of the Black Lives Matter movement and so on.
And I think it's so much that I think if I've got it right, it seemed like the current and the NBA it kind of spilled over into the NBA. Whereas I think that year,
correct,
the NBA championship didn't somehow broke. Maybe it was had Trump once Trump had gotten in to the White House, they boycotted. They didn't want to visit the White House. There was some sort of a
correct.
Spillover
yeah, into, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and a lot, most people, and actually a lot of people, don't even want politics to enter sports, right? Because they just want to separate it out. But, I think in a lot of ways, we're, as Americans, we're used to like singing the national anthem and used to saying Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, whatever. I mean, that's part of who we are. It's part of our identity. And we're not even aware, many Americans are not even aware of their own patriotism and so on. It's just part of who we are, right? And so, and of course, there's nothing wrong with that, but I just brought that up to kind of segue into understanding how nationalism itself is evocative in other places in the world, right? And in the Spanish cases, I think, is an interesting one, right? Because the Spanish government, it's a federal system. Spain is a new democracy because it was a dictatorship from 1939 to 1975 under Francisco Franco. And so after Franco died, they transitioned into democracy. And you have people like the Basques, who I studied, and then you have the Catalans, who wanted more autonomy and ultimately independence from Spain. And the Basques, unfortunately, at least some of them, not all of them, some of them believed that the use of violence was the way to go to become independent. So you had the terrorist group Euskalitas Katasuna, which is Basque Homeland and Freedom, which killed 830 people, 829 people, in its long history of terrorism from 1959 to 2010. 2011, and thank goodness, like, the separatist nationalists now are apologizing to victims, I don't think that project is totally complete. But, you know, that's, you know, the Basque are in northwest Spain and the Catalans are in northeast Spain, you know, Barcelona being the famous capital, which everybody visits, not really understanding Catalan politics very well. But, you know, the Catalans had a referendum in 2017. And, you know, it caused a huge controversy in Spain where the Spanish government felt the need to, you know, take over the region's government and kind of not go along with any of the Catalan independence movement, right?
Okay.
And interestingly, Ian, is that a scholar who's in, not going to name who he is, but he emailed me kind of a critique saying whether or not, you know, the Catalans were an ethnic group. And I said, well, they are, because you don't need to be an ethnic group based on biology, because it's been proven and written about that, you know, ethnicity is not necessarily biologically based, put that way.
Right. Yeah, no,
Anyway, so it kind of gives you the gist of it. And then, so what happened recently was that on October 14th, the Spanish Supreme Court sentenced to prison Catalan leaders, Catalan nationalist leaders. I guess one of the main persons is a guy by the name of Oriol Junqueras. He's a Catalan vice president. He was sentenced to 13 years. And then, of course, the guy who was kind of the head of the movement, Carles Puigdemont, he is living in Belgium in kind of self-exile. And they sent out a new arrest warrant to extradite the guy back to Spain. So that's kind of a long and short of it. So as a consequence of the Supreme Court judicial sentence, you have all these people protesting in the street and in many regards quite violently, and in many regards just gratuitous violence, to be honest with you.
So is this being interpreted as the reason I asked this is recently, the past few days, as a matter of fact, Dresden, the city, and there's a city in Germany that's having an extreme problem with white supremacy, or rather a resurrection of the Nazi movement, in so much that the city has declared it an emergency. Now, there's certainly, but that's ethically speaking, right? So, and ethics do overspill somewhat into government, right? And then I think that's one of the, me personally speaking, I think that's one of the fine kind of reasons why perhaps the U.S. Constitution is, it needs to be so strictly adhered to. And of course, there's amendments and interpretations, like any document or literature that's been previously written by people that are now deceased. But there's certainly some meshing. From this person who contacted you, is what's happening with the Catalonians, is it ethnically based, JP, or is there any merit to really this scholar's question?
So the Catalan identity is a language based identity, right? And so I think, I mean, because like one of my mentors at Oxford, like, he wrote a whole book on ethnicity. But if you simply look at ethnic movements from a biological basis, you're not going to understand the identity and belonging aspect of those groups. And as a matter of fact, so if you just look at, so just given the Basque case is another example.
Yeah.
If you look at the terrorist group Euskaita Escapasuno, or ETA, since the 1960s, really, okay, so in the turn of the 20th century, the late 19th century, early 20th century, a lot of people from throughout Spain, especially central Spain, moved to places like the Basque Country for jobs. The factory jobs were big in places like, in the Basque Country, places like Bilbao, because the steel industry was really strong. So people went from other parts of Spain to find work there. And interestingly enough, they identified with, you know, the regional people. With they married into Basques, and some of them learned Basque, some of them did not. If you were like, if you were interested in becoming political or becoming part of the terrorist organization, you weren't really barred from being part of the terrorist organization if you didn't speak Basque. But if you identified with the Basque traditions and ideas and so on, you're still considered, you know, part of that political movement, like being part of the violent separatist or a terrorist, without having like your parents being Basque or so on. Right. So being part of an ethnic group, is not in essence, not biologically based. So, and I'll give you another example. Like, so if you just take a general group like African Americans, right? And if somebody so chooses to have a DNA test and they find out, oh, well, my ancestors are from West Africa and in particular from Nigeria or Ghana, let's say, that African American person would still probably identify with being American, right? Sure. Like they're more closely aligned to being American than they are to West Africa.
Right.
Okay. So even though biologically, right, they, their DNA, they can trace it back to West Africa, their identity and belongingness, let's say if they're from, I don't know, Florida or Alabama or Georgia, they're more attuned to being from that region, having identity with those places, right? So that's why, like, anthropologists like myself and researchers don't give a lot of merit to the idea that ethnicity is necessarily tied to violence.
And this is,
I don't know if I explained it.
No, that's, you know, this is incredibly complex, and I think we're facing many of the same issues in the United States, so it kind of reverberates. What's happening in Spain and even in Brazil, I think, with these these indigenous folks, it's the same type of issue that they're facing, the same thing.
Yes, you know, in Brazil, like, you know, it's interesting about Brazil because if you don't mind, I can talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
So Brazil has its own ethnic categories that we don't even have in the U.S., right? I mean, it has an ethnic category of caboclo, which means somebody who has not only indigenous heritage, but white heritage, branco y indígena, right? Indígena. And so that is a category of somebody whose mixed ancestry is white and Amerindian would be a caboclo. You don't even have that category in the U.S. The census, Brazilian census, came up with a category called pardo, which means brown, okay? So that was category was set up for people who don't know necessarily their origins, but identify with not being white, but brown, okay? And so a lot of ethnicity and a lot of belongingness in many parts of the world, and if you want to get into issues of race, is tied into phenotype, right? Your skin color, your hair color, your hair type, your eye color, and so on. Tied into what's called phenotype, right? Your physical characteristics. Not necessarily your genotype, okay? Or your genetic inheritance. And by the way, we're more genetically like one of those than we are different. Mm-hmm. So in Brazil, the idea, there's several ideas. I mean, but with indigenous people, the general population who aren't anthropologists or who aren't educated have no understanding of indigenous people unless they're in contact with them or married into them or know them. The general population thinks that Amerindians or native peoples are naked, living in the forest, and are cannibals. Okay? That's in the popular Brazilian imagination. So to get around this idea that you can be dressed, you know, modernly, carry a cell phone, be educated as a lawyer, for example, drive a car, that to like the average Brazilian would be like, that is not an Indian, right? Anyway, so what I'm saying is that some of these notions of ethnicity and race are tied into popular stereotypes.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate.
Yeah. And the media can exacerbate if they like. They can dramatize or they can they can manipulate somehow if it works in their advantage.
Correct.
So JP, now tie in what happened there in Quebec in 1995.
So the Quebecois movement. So the referendum of what happened in Catalonia in 2017. Was the same thing what happened in Quebec. They had a referendum in 1995 and the Quebecois movement did not win. The same thing happened in Scotland, right? Recently.
Right.
The lesson, I guess, from this is that these nationalist movements aren't going away anytime soon. I just read recently in the BBC that the Welsh are interested in becoming independent too. You can go all over the world again and find different groups who want their own nations or territories. What's interesting is that, you know, indigenous people usually work within nations to have more autonomy. But these other political groups want their own states, right? So you have the Palestinians. You have the Kurds, right, in Turkey, Syria, Iraq, the Kachins in Myanmar. I mean, you just go all over the world. You have the Tamils, which is really religious-based, Tamil Tigers in Sri Lanka. Of course, with Brexit, with Britain exiting the Euro, the European Union, there's been the big talk about the Good Friday Agreement or the peace agreement, Northern Ireland falling apart and hard borders coming back to Northern Ireland and Ireland. So with the Quebecois movement, that also was a referendum movement of people who identify as French speaking, another language identity movement in Canada. Because as you have the English speaking Canada and the French speaking Canada. And the Quebec province, who are mostly French-speaking, who identify with French and the French language and French, as opposed to the English speakers, right? So that's how that works out that way.
Yeah, so JP, what is nationalism? Is from your understanding, is nationalism taking a stand and kneeling and protesting anthem and saying, hey, look, we've got problems in this country. I'm going to grab attention because I'm a famous athlete and I'm on a national stage, national broadcast TV. I'm going to take a knee and I'm going to say, I'm going to stand up for all whatever he's representing, which is, assuming it tied into the Black Lives Movement. Is he saying, whoever he represents is not having their voice heard. And, you know, I mean, I can right. say, I think you and I can both say, hey, you know, I mean, our voices aren't being heard. So anybody's, and that's kind of the Robin Hood effect of that needs to happen more and more, anywhere around the globe, but certainly in the United States. But who's patriotic? Are you patriotic? If you put your hand over your heart and no matter what, you know, no matter what country your country
I think in this country we have room for both, Ian. I think in this country we have room for both, obviously. you know, I believe in people's right to protest. And I think that my ancestors, I know you have ancestors that go all the way back to the founding fathers. I do too. I have, there were two brothers in my family that fought in the American Revolution. There, I have the city of Reno, Nevada was named after one of my family members who was a Union general in the Civil War.
Wow.
And then another ancestor who, his name was Marcus Reno, who I'm writing, I'm going to write a book about him. He escaped the Battle of Little Bighorn where Custer was slaughtered. And he escaped the battle, Ian, and was considered a coward his whole life, which wasn't true.
Oh.
Anyway, going to this idea of nationalism, and nationalism is what I would call a secular religion, right? People, it's a, what of what this political scientist, Benedict Anderson, called an imagined community. In other words, we imagine ourselves being part of one community, one nation, all believing in the flag, all believing in singing the national anthem, being imagining ourselves as one community, right? But, you know, what happens is that, of course, that people have different opinions about what it means to be part of a nation. Do you have a right to protest or not? Are the symbols of the nation too sacred to protest about? Like, these, there's even Supreme Court cases about burning the American flag, you know, and so on. So what does that mean as far as, you know, your identity and your belonging? The idea that, you know, what Benedict Anderson talked about was, you know, this is done, it was done through because of print media at the time, newspapers. But now we have the internet, we have different news channels catering to different political beliefs. And so the catering to media, catering to different political beliefs, has catered to there being division as far as what it means to be American, you know, like, I guess Fox News as opposed to MSNBC or something like that, you know, like, politics on the left or politics on the right, conservative or liberal, so-called. That has you know, made us, you know, blue and red, right? Or blue or red, even though that we're all Americans. You know, I don't really believe in this divide between Republicans and Democrats, because I think that we're all Americans, and whoever becomes the president is your president, regardless. And there's too much of the division today, Ian, unfortunately.
No, absolutely. I agree. Yep.
Yeah. And I think that those divisions can be false. But with every nationalist movement, you have factions, Ian. Like, so I'll just give you an example outside the U.S. Here you have the Basque movement. Though at the time, you know, those believing in violence for independence and those against violence for independence, right? So you have different political groups vying for attention and voters to get their messages across.
Right. So tying back in, and you're exactly right. It's an unnecessary divide. It's like, you know, the flag is red, white, and blue, yet you're blue or you're red, depending on your beliefs. And in reality, well, we're all in the same boat here. We're one of the same. But,
right,
as far as annexation, you've got an incredibly strong movement in California, and Texas is not far behind. You've got Hawaii and Alaska in those discussions. So something that all Americans need to be concerned about, because I'll parallel this, JP, to the Treaty of Guadalupe. And what I think a lot of Mexicans don't know, and I've spent a lot of time in Mexico and I speak a good amount of Spanish, but I think, and I love the country of Mexico, but what a lot of Mexicans don't understand and what a lot of Americans don't understand is that New Spain began falling apart, and it kind of lost its top and bottom strongholds, which on, you know, I think parts of Guatemala and other what are considered Central American countries were once part of New Spain, and which became Mexico under Guadalupe right. Victoria. But Texas and California and Mexico, Arizona, they were even on the flag. It says Republic of Texas, Republic of California. And so, like any large kind of organization, it's hard to keep your loose ends tight and close to you. So what's next for the Catalonian people? What do you see? What do you see for them?
Yeah, I just want to touch on the history that you brought up, because it's something that I also teach about. That, you know, the Mexican-American War was called Polk's War, right? And it's interesting, Polk sent down a representative down to Mexico to try to buy California, which it was called California at the time, but California at the time also included, as you know, Arizona, New Mexico, parts of Colorado, Nevada, and so on. And Mexicans refused, and they were having their own kind of civil war. And we provoked that war because the Mexicans believed that the borders were at the Nueces River, which is north of the Rio Grande, and Polk put troops down to the Rio Grande and provoked the Mexicans into fighting that war. And we, as you know, just mentioned that we got a huge amount of territory, which is like half of Mexico.
Yeah.
We got California, we got Arizona, we got New Mexico, we got Nevada, we got parts of Colorado. And then Texas, of course, had become part of the U.S. prior to that, or annexed part of that. But what's the future for Catalonia? It's like all these groups with failed nationalism, Ian, going to your question. They'll still want independence from Spain, even though Spain's not going to give that up. It'd be like, yeah, Texas or Alaska separating or whatever. And, you know, you have Spanish nationalism competing with Catalan nationalism. So you have these two nationalisms, right? And if you're a Spaniard, you'd say, well, there's only one nationalism, it's only Spain, right?
Right.
That Catalonia and the whole idea of a Catalonia is a figment. See, but the problem is the history of this goes back to Francisco Franco, the dictator, oppressing those regions, Ian, and not letting the language, not letting people speak Basque or Catalan, right? And by disallowing Catalan to be spoken in the street or Basque to be spoken in the street, and by not allowing it to be taught in schools, you had this underground movement, right? And so it's still strong today. And even recently, you just have the Francisco Franco was just disinterred. He was reburied, right? He was taken out of the Valle de los Caídos, where he was buried in this big mausoleum, and he was taken out and reburied in the cemetery, right? So the Spanish Civil War, which was from 1936 to 1939, is still with a living memory of many Spaniards, right?
Sure, sure.
So with the Catalan movement, it's not going to go away. Neither is the Scottish movement, neither is the Welsh movement, neither is the Quebecois movement. Neither is the Oromo movement in Ethiopia, neither is the British Cameroon movement in Cameroon, neither are the Tamils in Sri Lanka. I mean, you know, you can go all around the world and look at these different movements. West Papua New Guinea is another one in Indonesia. We have the Indonesian government using soldiers and oppressing a lot of people in Papua New Guinea. And I call it the West Papua New Movement, but you know, Papua New Guinea is one of the most language diverse and ethnically diverse places on earth. Hundreds of languages and different peoples, but it's kind of a nationalist movement going on that unites different ethnic groups. So it's interesting.
Yeah, you bring up some great points, JP, and we can get into, you know, one of the things I haven't really gone into, but certainly a language spoken. So, like I mentioned, I speak a pretty good amount of Spanish, enough to have a very basic kind of conversation that's, you know, a few minutes long, sort of thing. But Spanish is a totally different way of thinking, as opposed to conjuring up a or developing a sentence or a phrase in English, and doing so right. in Spanish right. is differently. So,
right.
you know, what are the elements of the culture that went into developing that language, and how are those elements culturally different than what went into developing English? Right. And of course we're looking at centuries
right.
of
right.
centuries of history, right. right. Of culture. But, anyway,
yeah, no, I mean, English is basically a Germanic language, Indo-European language. And as you know, also that, Spanish is a Romance language. It's like Portuguese. I'm fluent in Spanish and Portuguese, and I'm not a native speaker, but I lived 3 years in Spain and I lived in Brazil.
Yeah.
I used to be fluent in Basquian, but I don't practice it enough to be fluent in it. And Basque, the language itself, Euskera, is a non-Indo-European language, and its autochthonous means that it developed there. There's still really no ties to any other language.
Wow.
In non-Indo-European language, I mean, it's just not related to anything else. So most European languages are Indo-European, right? And that would include Spanish and Portuguese. But yes, languages have their own mentalities. And when we lose languages, which is happening with indigenous languages around the world,
sure.
we're losing whole worldviews, whole ideas about the world, about how to think about the world, how to be in the world. And it's, you know, thank goodness for linguists and anthropologists to preserve or have preserved and have recorded some of these dying languages, right? And it's happening all the time.
Yeah.
That's one of the worries about, language oppression or language loss, is that, you know, the majority of languages are English, Spanish,
Chinese, Russian.
And of course, Chinese, Mandarin Chinese, Hindi as well.
Sure, sure.
But with that, with language dominance and with communication the way it is, with television and cell phones and the way things are going, you have language losses as well.
And then mathematics is a completely other language.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, mathematics is called the universal language, and it's the human way of understanding the universe and how it works, right? How the physics work, and people are trying to put together what's called the string theory, right? Ultimate relativity of how the quantum world, how the microscopic relates to the larger universe and things like gravity and so on. People who've worked in quantum mechanics and things like that have tried to make grander theories about that. But that's, I would also argue that, and I've argued this with my friends who are physicists, so it's not like, I would say that's a human interpretation of the universe, the physical universe. Although they might argue that, well, is there any other interpretation? And we don't know, right? We just don't know yet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Great, great, great.
And there could be higher intelligence out there. We don't know. I don't know.
Well, there definitely is. I mean, it's got to be. I mean, there's something, but it may not be something we can even comprehend, right? I mean, it may not be like
you're correct.
It may not be
something exactly.
We can quantify it.
That you could quantify, right.
JP, what is, looking forward to having you back on next month. Again, this is the Leinster Up the Port, and we aim to bring it the first Wednesday of every month. JP, what's on the horizon for you? What are you working on next?
So I'm waiting to hear back about my book of poetry, which is called Epical Reckonings.
Beautiful.
So I'm waiting to hear about from some publishers and surprises about that. And that book is really a poetic interpretation of 21st century major events, a lot of about racism, interpretations about that. And then I'm currently writing an article about what's going on in Amazonia and Brazil. And then I have another book coming out in regards to basically the op-eds that that you've seen in Counterpunch, that's going to be more of an academic slanted book on some of those topics.
Excellent. And these can be found. Do you have a website, JP, where you list your books? Are they available on Amazon?
Yes. My books are available on Amazon.com. And I also have an academic website, which is on academia.edu. And if you look at that website, you can type in JP Lindstraw and find me there, or just look up my books on Amazon.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, JP Lindstraw. JP, thank you for joining the program again. We look forward to having you back on.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure. And I'm just so great to be on your show. And I just want to offer my congratulations for things moving forward with the show. I think that's terrific. And just thank you for inviting me on again. It's always a pleasure.
All right. Take care, JP. Talk to you soon.
All right. Take care. Bye.
JP Lindstroth is an incredible academic mind. And incredible mind outside of academia as well. Just a wonderful person. JP and I have known each other now, I think, going on about 2 years, and we've been doing we've been collaborating here on the JP or the Lindstroth Report. It's been a few months. I'd have to get an exact reading on that, but it's been a couple of months. I'll be right back. I'll be back with some closing comments for you. You've tuned to Wynnewood Radio. This is Wynnewood Radio, Ian Trottier, for Discussions of Truth. And a little tool for you. Amy Waters Yarsinsky, the author of several best-selling, award-winning nonfiction books, most recently An American in the Basement, The Betrayal of Captain Scott Spaker, and The Cover-Up of His Death. The book won the Next Generation Indie Book Award for General Nonfiction in 2015. While the book has led to major media interviews and speaking engagements across the country for Amy, it importantly continues the national conversation of POW/MIA accountability, which is, of course, incredibly important for national security. Amy's new books include a historical series based on her favorite Virginia, North Carolina, and Washington, D.C. locales and historic sites, the first of which, Norfolk Through Time, was published on Spring List last year. A whistleblower's story set against the backdrop of a rampant scientific misconduct. The biography of one of America's greatest 20th century aviators, the story of a murder in Tehran that would change the trajectory of history. Two more narratives that will make it clear that America still has a crisis of accountability for its missing service members, and the story of Norfolk Botanical Garden, a Virginia historical landmark that is also listed on the National Registry of Historical Places. Amy's coming up here in the short future, and then within the next month, she'll be joining the program. And as mentioned in discussion with JP, the show, Discusses the Truth, that is in talks with a very small production company based in Manhattan to do a monthly show for television there. That is in development, and if as it continues to be negotiated, you will be receiving updates on such. You've tuned in to Wynwood Radio. This is Ian Hamilton Trottier. That is I. And I'll be back next week with another installment of the program. And most importantly, former BBC employee Anna Breeze. Follow me on Twitter. Follow me on Instagram. That's IANTROTTIER. Go to my website, INTROTTIER.com. That's IanTrottier.com. You can find all my past guests, and you can discover more about Freedom Reserved, No More Lies. My book being published in the 2020 catalog via Trine Day. Coming your way, spring 2020. And until next week, be awesome.